This podcast is brought to you by MITEX, the Massachusetts Innovation and Technology Exchange, the region's premier association for thought leadership, technology trends, building business relationships, and professional training and development. For more information, go to www.mitx.org.
Hey, get your fresh bizcast here. I'm DC Dennison. This week, Christopher Reedy on the evolution of the textbook as he examines a fourth grade text coming from Houghton Mifflin that demonstrates many of the ways that textbooks are changing. Then, Jeffrey Krasner on two inky topics, a innovator in the real stuff who is experimenting with different colors and capabilities, and e-ink, a Cambridge-based MIT spinoff that could change the way we read. First up, Christopher Reedy. So, Chris Reedy, you just wrote a fascinating article about the integrated textbook. What goes into the integrated textbook?
What I looked at was Houghton Mifflin, which is a Boston company, and they've spent the last 4 or 5 years coming up with a new fourth grade science textbook that they hope will be ready for next year's academic year. And so integrated means that they looked at a number of different medium. They have the textbook, obviously, itself, and then they have DVDs that were produced to complement the textbook. They have websites that they have specifically designed for the book, and then there are also ancillary materials to help teachers. And some of the thinking behind this is, well, first of all, kids are harder to reach these days.
Yeah. Is that the Game Boy and MTV influence?
Yeah, I talked to somebody from MIT, and he said, you know, we're competing with eyeballs for and the attention span of this generation that's been raised with all this these technologies.
Yeah.
And we have to adapt some of that to be able to grab on and capture the attention of this group. Now, in talking to Houghton Mifflin, they emphasize a different point, that the integrated textbook using all these different media helps them reach students in different ways.
So is this based on research into different learning styles? Is that part of what's driving it?
Yeah, I think so. I think what the research shows or is that different kids learn differently. Some absorb a lesson best the old-fashioned way, just by reading text. But there are others who need to hear a lesson, that somehow that gets through to them. And still another group needs to visually see it through simulations or video. And for many kids, you want to have all three. They need to see, hear, and read. I mean, that combination of factors really drives home the message, and that is something that they are looking, Houghton Mifflin is looking to achieve by this integrated textbook.
I also noticed the designs are much different, and you pointed out that magazines used to be the influence on textbook designers, but that's waning.
Yeah, I guess a decade or so ago, I'm told that that many textbooks look to magazines to sort of a mix of words and images to carry a storyline. Now the thinking has evolved, and there's a delicate balance to be struck here, that they want to, in textbook authors, want to engage and capture a child's attention, a student's attention, but they don't want to distract him or her. And so they've decided to keep the images, keep some separation between the images and the text, so that you can focus on one at a time.
And the text doesn't seem to flow from page to page in these textbooks. It seems to be very much, you know, kind of a unit of text, and then there's a unit of graphics, and then you turn the page, and there are different units there. It doesn't sort of flow. You're not turning pages and following a narrative of any kind.
Well, Houghton Mifflin says that the one thing that they need to recognize is how diverse the student population is these days. And it's not just simply a case of many students who who speak English as a second language is also in what we were talking about earlier about how different students learn differently mm-hmm. from reading, from seeing, from hearing. Mm-hmm. And so, again, they're trying to communicate or convey this educational content in several different ways.
Yeah. One interesting approach that you highlight in the article is this inquiry-based question approach, where instead of asking kids to memorize things, they try to put the kids kind of in the place of a scientist asking about something. Is that something that, is that a new approach?
That's certainly an approach that they're using in this book. And mm-hmm. They have like little biographies or little features of scientists and the DVDs that come with the book. You know, they show you how to conduct experiments, and the whole idea is to get across the message that you can be a scientist or you can mm-hmm. be an inventor, and it's kind of a big mystery and a big puzzle that you should be intrigued about.
Mm-hmm. And the students who are really curious, what you refer to as the students ready for a challenge, are often sent off the textbook entirely onto web resources. Like, here's if you really are pursuing this topic, or you're ready for more, or you want more, here's where the resources are on the web for you.
Sure. They've specifically designed web pages to complement the book. I mean, there's all kinds of, and they struck up an agreement with a publishing company, all to kind of supplement the textbook with additional information for kids who want more.
Yeah, I remember somebody telling me at Houghton Mifflin that they had, 800. They hosted 800 websites or something, because every textbook has a series of websites. And so here was this company that most people probably think of as kind of old school, no pun intended, mm-hmm. and here they're hosting all these websites. So it's interesting that they're at that, edge.
Right. They said that when I talked to them about this textbook, they said that maybe 100 editors and writers were involved in a key portion of the project, but there were also 40 people who are, into things like DVD production and web page design.
I see. So, wow. So, finally, you end the story by hinting that the textbook of the future may be kind of splintered in terms of there's going to be all new technologies. Every new technology will be sort of applied to it as the general media culture sort of gets more narrow. Textbooks may get more narrow. Is that the way you see things happening or playing out, long term?
I would think that at some point I talked to a professor at Harvard, and he thinks that, maybe someday a teacher would be writing a blog or doing podcasts. And again, I mean, using all this technology to advance the learning experience, and I think you're still going to need the kind of expertise that a Houghton Mifflin has, but it will be presented in some different format. They may not be, someday in the future, we might not think of them as a textbook company, but as a learning company, and just presenting the content in a variety of formats.
Kind of a learning media company or something.
Yes.
Yeah. Great. Hey, Chris Reedy, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So, Jeff Krasner, you just wrote a two-part series on ink in the Globe. Ink Real and Virtual is the way I sort of read it. What about real ink? Is there much room for innovation there?
Well, I found this fascinating entrepreneur down in southeastern Massachusetts. His name is Nathan Tardif, and his company is called Noodlers, Inc.
Yeah, I love that.
And that's N-O-O-D-L-E-R-S, Noodlers, Inc.
Okay.
And he's been a fountain pen aficionado for a lot of years. He's 31 now. I remember seeing him at pen shows 15 years ago. I'm also a pen collector.
Wow.
So I had a personal interest in this story. And then 2 years ago, he started making his own ink, after he received a challenge from a fountain pen user.
What was that?
And the challenge was, if you can invent an ink that I can use to fill out a newspaper crossword puzzle, and the ink isn't going to feather out all over the page, and it isn't going to blot through to the back, I'll buy 18 bottles from you. And the thing about Nathan is he's extremely entrepreneurial, and he likes to think that he can figure out a way to do things better. Mm-hmm. And he's fascinated by pens, and he very quickly learned a lot about ink, and there's all sorts of technology involving the dyes and how you get different types of effects from the ink. And he's not a chemist by training. He has a business degree, but he went around and he just soaked up knowledge, so to speak, from people all over the place, including some folks at UMass Dartmouth.
Wow, he must be, I mean, that is, you think of the ink technology, how far back that goes, and I think it must use, like, some really noxious chemicals, too.
Well, I learned a few interesting things about ink, and one of the things was that all pen inks are vulnerable to attack by molds and bacteria.
Really?
And yeah, and so if you don't put some kind of preservative in the ink, you'll open up the bottle and there'll be molds growing on top and it's ruined.
Hmm.
And so one of the things Nathan told me, which I didn't mention in the story today, was that inks from, according to Nathan, inks from China and other countries might have some really nasty stuff to prevent the mold growth, like, you know, mercury chemicals you know, chromium and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah, right, right. Wow. So is there an audience? Is there a market for these nutty inks?
Well, first let's tell our listeners a little bit about these nutty inks.
Right, okay.
Now, there's been a tremendous resurgence in the traditional fountain pen, and there's one of the facts I was able to look up about the industry is they're selling 17.5 million fountain pens a year in the U.S.
Wow.
And while that's a tiny fraction compared to the market for ballpoints and rollerballs and felt tips and all of those, it's just so much more than it was 10 or 20 years ago when fountain pens had really disappeared. So there's tremendous numbers of people who are buying these pens and using them, and they love them because of the way they write, and that many of the fountain pens are beautiful and they're fun to use. You fill them from an ink bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, everybody's got their favorite ink.
Uh-huh.
And if I didn't mention, I am a pen collector, and so I've been known to visit some of the pen chat rooms on the web. There's a good one at Pen Hero, and there's another one that's Pen Lovers, and there's a lot of different places people can go to exchange news and views with other pen folk.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always some kind of bitter dispute about what ink is best and what ink is best for a vintage pen, what ink is best for a different kind of pen or a calligraphy pen. Parker put out a line of inks about 10 years ago that were called Pen Man inks.
Mm.
And they had very rich colors.
Yeah, I think I've seen those actually.
And they had very rich colors, but they had a tendency to clog up some of the antique pens. And so there were endless, you know, running debates and back and forth about, you know, is Pen Man ink safe to use? Should I use it? You know, what about the Mont Blanc inks or Schaefer? And there's all sorts of smaller brands that are sort of boutique inks.
Mm-hmm.
And Noodlers falls into that.
Yeah.
And so what could I say about what distinguishes Noodlers? The colors are eye-popping. They're really vibrant. They're very rich. Some pen inks I've used, you know, you'll pick out what seems like a nice green or red, and when it hits the paper, it looks kind of washed out. So mm-hmm. Noodler's inks have really strong colors.
Mm-hmm.
And he has all kinds of funny names for his inks. The names themselves are kind of fun. He has a really deep red that looks a little bit like blood, which he named Antietam, which is after the famous Civil War battle. So anyway, you know, he has a lot of fun with the names. And he's also taken ink in some extraordinary directions. He's sort of taken this ancient medium. Inks have been around for 5,000 years. And one of the things I learned when I was doing the story was the Chinese first invented indelible ink, and it was something like 4,600 BC, if I recall correctly.
Wow, that's amazing.
And so Nathan has a particular ink. It's Noodler's, I believe it's Indelible Black. It may have another name, but it's right there on his website. Uh-huh. And it's designed to be impervious to any kind of tampering by a forger or somebody who would want to take your check and change the amount.
Yeah, yeah.
And you talk to Nathan, and he's got all these different experiments he's done on this ink. And ultimately what he says is, You can write something on a piece of paper and put that piece of paper in a flask of industrial bleach, very strong, harsh chemical. And he says the actual fibers of the paper will disintegrate before the ink is corrupted in any way. And so he's also, he's posted, I guess you could call it a challenge on his website, where he says if anybody can take his black, his indelible black, and use it on a standard security check and change the number.
Mm-hmm.
Take it off and replace it with something else. He'll pay you $1,000.
Wow.
Now, he anticipates that nobody is going to be able to meet this challenge. After a year, it goes to $2,000, and after another year, it goes to $3,000.
Oh, really? Wow.
And so then he's done some other really kind of interesting things with ink. He has this line of polar inks,
mm-hmm.
polar black, which if you've ever read any of the stories about the explorers going to the South Pole, who was that famous explorer?
Perry, I don't know.
Yeah, Richard Perry, who perished in the South
yeah.
Pole. He was keeping a diary, and one of the problems he had was his ink would freeze.
Oh. So.
Okay, so Nathan has polar black, which is guaranteed to flow freely down to 110 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. He says he sells it in Scandinavia.
Really? Wow. He also, the one ink of his that I've seen was kind of an electric yellow highlighter ink.
Yeah, it's amazing ink. He calls it Firefly.
Oh, yeah.
And he not only makes the ink, you know, we've all used those yellow highlighters, and mm-hmm. they seem pretty bright when they hit the page.
Right, right.
But if you were to use a regular highlighter and then draw a line next to it with his Firefly ink, the Firefly ink just pops out. It's really,
really
bright. And he also makes his own pen, which has a super broad 5-millimeter broad nib that is a fountain pen that you can use as a highlighter.
I
doesn't
see.
Write just a single line, puts a whole stripe down.
That's a prestige item.
It
to have a fountain pen highlighter.
It's
could be.
It's the way that Nathan loves to do different things with pens and with ink that have never been done before.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also doing some exotic things which aren't yet on the market. He says he's working on a thing called Bumblebee ink.
Yeah, that caught my attention.
And that's going to, if he's able to perfect it, that's going to write a line, and within the line will be alternating yellow and black stripes. And he gave me an explanation of how it works, and the way it works is the ink has two different dyes in it, the yellow and the black, and they have different qualities, so they move through the paper at different speeds.
Wow.
And so that creates different colors at different points in the line.
Wow.
He's working on glow-in-the-dark ink.
Oh, okay.
Which he says could have military applications, and I don't know whether it would or it wouldn't. I don't know, you know, if I could see somebody in a tank pulling out a fountain pen, but who knows? I could be wrong. He's not quite there yet, but he's working on it, and he's talking about, you know, there are a lot of materials that when you expose them to light, they store the energy and then will release the energy over time, mm-hmm. you know, glow-in-the-dark balls and all those kind of things.
Right.
But he's facing a challenge in getting these crystals down to a small enough size that they could be suspended in the ink and would flow through the pen.
I see.
So that's part of the challenge there. He's also working on a Christmas ink, which would he said it would be it would be triggered by the temperature, and depending on the temperature, the ink would either show up as green or red, different Christmas colors, and would change. And he says he has that, but
we gotta go.
Oh, what, you're in here?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Jeff. So we were just interrupted by the looked like it was the national desk coming in for their afternoon conference and kicked us out of the conference room.
Well, these things happen to podcasters. You just have to roll with it, DC.
Okay. So we rolled up to another conference room. But as I recall, you were just in the middle of describing a Noodler's Ink Christmas ink.
This is still under development, and the ink would change color from red to green and also maybe to black, depending on the temperature. And Nathan told me that he has an ink that'll work, but at this point it would cost $24 a bottle.
Oh.
And he needs to get it down. He charges $12. The average retail price on his ink is $12 for a 3-ounce bottle, which actually is less than what a lot of fancy ink costs, because usually you're getting 1.5 ounces, and his bottle is much larger.
I see. So any other inks? This guy is definitely an innovator.
I think he's done amazing stuff with this ancient medium.
Yeah.
He says he's working on a white ink, which he says is really difficult. I mean, we think of white, it shouldn't be hard, but, you know, white paint or whiteout fluid, those are paints. Those aren't inks.
Oh, interesting.
And so, you know, they rely on coatings, not dyes. And so he's still working on something that would be a true ink that would come out the color white.
That's interesting.
And he also mentioned, we said a moment ago, he's looking at glow-in-the-dark ink. He's also working on glow-in-the-dark paper.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
I was wondering when pen aficionados were going to get into paper as well, but I'm sure that's part of it, too.
Yeah. So he has a distributor which distributes his inks nationwide and internationally. And you can find Nathan at a lot of the major pen shows. And if you're interested in his inks, I'd suggest you just go to his website, noodlersink.com.
Mm-hmm.
Just put Noodler's Ink into Google and it'll take you right there. And you'll see the inks, the colors are really something, and it gives you a little flavor of what Nathan is like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's the kind of guy who he loves a challenge, and he's a little ornery, and he's kind of like, nobody else can do it, well, I'm going to do it.
I see.
And he said that one of the things that really bothered him was he lives in Dartmouth, Mass, in the southeast part of the state, which isn't too far from Rhode Island,
mm-hmm.
and A.T. Cross Company, which is in Lincoln, Rhode Island. And he learned that A.T. Cross was making their ink overseas.
Oh.
And that really bugged him. You know, he's a real made in America kind of guy. And he said to himself, not only can I make better ink, but I can make it here in Massachusetts and still earn a profit on it. So
wow. I think if I could nominate MacArthur Genius Grants, you know, this guy needs one.
Oh, you know, definitely.
To just keep him going in his basement. I'm assuming he works in a basement.
He works in his basement.
Yeah. Something about that.
His house, every available surface is covered with antique pens and pen parts and packages from pen collectors. And I mentioned that he's making this fountain pen highlighter, so that involves a lot of metal work where he's making these super broad nibs and tipping them himself in iridium and ruthenium, these two very hard metals. And so he's got this whole workshop in his basement, and then he also took me into the bottling room, which is in the basement, where he's got this set up with different vats and rubber hoses and boxes and boxes of his bottles, which he labels and fills one at a time. So it's a real bootstrap operation, and I think it's a lot of fun, and I think he's done some remarkable things with what is an ancient medium.
Now, did you get a whiplash when you went from him to E-Ink over in the MIT neighborhood?
Well, the E-Ink is just the other side of the spectrum.
Yeah, couldn't be further away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And not only in terms of what kind of an operation is, but what they're trying to do with it.
Mm-hmm. And what are they trying to do? What would you say their sort of mission is right now?
I would say that E-Ink's mission is to change visual presentation of information, and that includes things like newspapers, which we hope some of our listeners are still familiar with the daily newspaper.
Let's hope.
And things like point of sale displays, mm-hmm. and clocks, and just all sorts of different displays. Mm-hmm. And I think the best way to describe it is to talk a little bit about this thing they've created, which they call electronic ink.
Mm-hmm.
And
how does it work?
It starts, it's a liquid, mm-hmm. hence they call it ink. And the liquid contains these micro capsules, each the diameter of a human hair, which seems to be sort of the standard measurement of anything that's really small.
Yeah.
And inside each of these micro capsules are two kinds of dyes. One is titanium dioxide, which is white. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that makes white paint white. Hmm. And also little particles of carbon, which is black.
Mm-hmm.
And the white particles and the black particles have different charges. And so this ink is put onto a substrate, and you can apply a charge to it.
Right.
And so depending on the charge you apply at each little point, the microcapsules will display either white or black on the surface.
Right.
And so if you can think of a picture, it's pixelated or shot through a screen, essentially, mm-hmm. and then they can display it in black and white just by changing the charge on each point underneath the microcapsules.
Yeah, yeah. And they've been pursuing this for a number of years, right?
They're an MIT spinoff. One of the scientific co-founders is Professor Joe Jacobson at the MIT Media Lab, famous startup creator.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped create the chemistry behind the electronic ink. And let me see, they were founded in either 96 or 97.
Mm-hmm.
And they've attracted, at this point, $100 million in venture capital. And it's a remarkable collection of funders that they have. That instead of just your usual VC companies, they have funding from some of the really big media companies, including Hearst Corporation and Gannett, the big newspaper publisher, and McClatchy, which is also a very big newspaper publisher, and a whole bunch of different air products and chemicals, which is they supply industrial gases like oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
They're also an investor in the company.
Mm.
So an interesting bunch of investors.
And you can see why they all have some stake in the future of, you know, reading material.
And I guess one of the most... So let's talk about some of the prosaic things that they're applying this to.
Mm-hmm.
So Seiko designed a watch which uses this display film, And it's a very stylish thin wristwatch, mm-hmm. and the display is this e-ink display. It's like a curved piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And what really differentiates it from all the digital watches out there with liquid crystal displays is that e-ink only consumes energy when you change the display. As long as the display is static, it's not drawing any energy from the battery.
I see.
So it gets tremendous, tremendous battery life compared to the average electronic watch.
I see. That's interesting.
And they also have a clock that was designed by Citizens, another big watch and clock company. Mm-hmm. And I think this is more of a display clock that you'd put up on the wall, or it's curved, so I guess you could put it on a column in a building. But unfortunately, neither one of these are yet available in the U.S. They were also working with Sony, and what they created with Sony was an electronic book reader where it looks and feels like a paperback book, and it displays one page at a time on this e-ink display, mm-hmm. and then you can hit a button and change to the next page.
Now, that's available in Japan?
That was introduced last year in Japan, and they believe Sony is going to introduce it into the U.S., but not quite yet.
So there was a kind of a boom in e-book kind of stuff a few years ago. I bet it's hard to bring out a new one now and get, you know, excitement, because some people have probably been burned by it.
Some people have probably said that that's something that's come and gone.
Yeah, but I think I still think there's room. Somebody's going to... Their display will probably be thinner than the ones that were in the first generation.
Well,
more papery, maybe.
The way they described it to me, and I was talking to one of their senior marketing managers, Darren Bischoff, is that their display is more papery, more mm-hmm. paperbackish, if you will.
Oh, I see.
That it's designed to be the size and shape and feel the same as a paperback book. Mm-hmm. And he said that they purposely didn't put a light or a backlight onto the page.
Oh, interesting. Oh, I just assumed it would have that.
And so looking at it feels more like looking at a printed page.
Right, right.
And also that preserves the wonderful battery performance, and also it doesn't make it like you wouldn't use it in the bed at night without putting a light on.
Yeah.
You still have to access it the same way you would an actual paperback.
Yeah. Now, the last time I caught up with them, they were doing point of display signs. Did that pan out?
I think that's something that's going to be introduced, but with each of these products, they don't produce the product themselves. They hook up with a company that's more involved in that particular line, like the clock company or the watch company. They provide the e-ink medium, and then that company develops the product and sells it.
I see. So they're dependent on, for their product rollouts, on these partners.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know that they're doing testing in Germany on giant displays for train times in the terminals.
Oh, huh.
And any of our listeners who have been to South Station, and you see the little times flip over.
Yeah, I love that, actually.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun when it happens.
Yeah.
But you can see how that's kind of an old-fashioned medium. It's mechanical.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And who knows how often that goes wrong, and they got to get a little guy up on a ladder to fix it.
I know. It's always in, like, Every commercial about, like, New York City, there's always a shot of Grand Central Station with those things flipping over.
Exactly.
That indicates, you know, urban excitement, even though it's some real...
You're in the big station.
Yeah, even though it's like this incredibly old, you know, clackety technology. So, yeah, they've got a market.
So they would use this for a giant display where mm-hmm. you could change the type very easily. And it would have the same readability that the ones that flip over do,
mm-hmm.
but it could be more reliable. So that's something that's still in testing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think one of the most interesting things they're doing that we had in today's paper is that they want to transform the newspaper.
Yes. Yeah. In what way? What do you think the most... I remember the term radio paper. Is that what you
mentioned?
Right.
That's their trademark term for what they envision as what will be their iteration of the newspaper. And what it would be is a newspaper-sized sheet of this display medium. And because the e-ink display looks and feels so much like paper, you could treat it like a piece of newspaper.
Right.
And so it would look like a printed piece of paper, perhaps a business and innovation section, D.C.
Yeah, that would be appropriate.
And but it would update. So instead of, you know, at the end of the day, you've read your newspaper, so you put it in the recycle bin because the what's printed on the pages can't change. The radio paper would get perhaps a download periodically during the day, or maybe at some point even a real-time download, and the display that you see would continue to change. So if you were interested in a developing story, say Hurricane Katrina relief efforts, and you know, FEMA was announcing something, or the mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, was announcing something, the place on the paper that had the coverage of New Orleans would change during the day, and you can get an actual update.
I love that idea.
And yet it has so many of the qualities of the actual, of the original paper medium that make newspapers still a viable a prospect, which is they're transportable. You can look at them very easily. It's easier to manipulate than a computer screen.
Right, or a TV screen.
Right. Yeah. And they're portable.
Yeah.
And they're lightweight. And so I don't know exactly where they are in the development of the radio paper, but it's a fascinating concept.
Yeah.
And I think it's one that shows a lot of promise and would make great use of this display they have. They also talked about some other really far out things, like you could have a display that would sort of unroll from your cell phone. So you could pull out a little scroll from your cell phone, and so if you were downloading email from your cell phone or your BlackBerry, you wouldn't have this tiny screen that you were stuck with. You could have a much larger screen.
Yeah. Wow. Did that thing just turn off?
Yeah.
Huh. Let's see.
I don't know. The blue just went away.
Yeah. Okay, Jeff, sorry about that. We had a little technical difficulty as you were describing the cell phone application. Now, what was that again?
Yeah. E-Ink foresees a potential use for their display where if you were retrieving your email, say, on a cell phone or news headlines on a cell phone or a BlackBerry, you know, one of the things that makes it tough is their screens are so small. So they envision maybe having like a little slot you could open up and actually pull out a screen from the side of your cell phone, and then you'd have maybe, you know, 6 inches wide by 3 inches deep, and you could really see a nice block of type at once.
Wow.
So that's another thing that they're thinking of, which I think could really enable cell phones and BlackBerries to be even more useful.
I'd rather have that than MP3s on my phone.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's hope Nokia is listening.
Hey, great. Well, Jeff, thanks for this incredibly wide-ranging interview. I don't think I've ever done a interview on this BizCast that went from ink to electronic ink that far. So thanks a lot.
Great to join you, DC.
Thanks for listening. And check in next Wednesday for a brand new BizCast. Or better yet, subscribe and have BizCast automatically delivered to your computer and MP3 player.